Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Taxes, schools, and nuclear radiation. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCIW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. A few Republicans are behind closed doors with Governor Brown negotiating about the budget and a vote of the people on taxes. Some colleagues label them traitors. If Brown agrees to what they're asking, he's in for trouble with environmentalists and public sector unions. With schools waiting to see if they'll get enough state money to save teachers' jobs, we'll hear calls for compromise from both sides. Also tonight, the run on potassium iodide pills for radiation protection. Health physicists say they're not needed here. Later on, is the war in Afghanistan being forgotten? First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. It's a crucial moment for the war in Afghanistan, but General David Petraeus is not getting much attention as he tells Congress about what he calls progress that is fragile and reversible. With public opinion turning against the war, what's next for 98,000 American soldiers? First, potassium iodide pills. Since word of the Japanese nuclear crisis broke last Friday night, pharmacies have been contacted by customers worried about exposure to radiation that can cause thyroid cancer. Is potassium iodide really needed? Regina Benjamin is the Surgeon General of the United States.
I'm not sure that there's a level of need right now, and certainly the health officers are monitoring. We at CDC are monitoring and will certainly alert the public if there's ever, you know, a real threat.
Catherine Higley is professor and head of the Department of Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics at Oregon State University. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
What about this? The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is saying today that the radiation is extremely high now coming from Japan. The winds are in our direction. What does that mean?
Well, so just to put things in context, I've been in the field for about 35 years doing environmental radiation protection and health physics, and I've done a lot of emergency response work. And in order for this material to get over from Japan to here, it really needs to be transported more than 5,000 miles, first of all, and it's going to undergo a tremendous amount of dilution, dispersion. There's winter storms that are going to be raining upon the Pacific and physically knocking this material out of the air. And so the likelihood of it getting here is very remote. Also, the releases are pretty close to the ground level in sort of atmospheric terms. And so typically those kinds of releases simply do not travel very far because they come in contact with surfaces, they adhere to surfaces, and again, salt spray, rain, and such are going to knock this material out of the air.
Close to ground level, isn't a lot of it in the steam that's rising up into the air?
But even still, I mean, even if it goes, you know, 100 meters or more up into the air, the transport, this is considered a near-surface sort of phenomenon, and so it really does not travel very far because there's a lot of near-surface activity that's going to help knock it out of the air.
Well, now, local pharmacies say there is virtually no potassium iodide available because normally there is almost no demand, and apparently the manufacturers are sending as much of it as they can to Japan.
I mean, I think having it for the people in the vicinity, you know, in the exclusion zone surrounding the plant, that is certainly a very good precaution because they're the ones that potentially can be exposed to the iodine that's coming out of the plant. But people here on the west coast of the United States, absolutely not. There's no need for this. You know, said I'm a radiation protection specialist. I'm a mother. I have children. We're not stocking up on potassium iodide. It's really absolutely unnecessary.
You spent 14 years at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State. Did you see a lot of radiation exposure there? And if so, what's the consequences of it?
Well, they take radiation exposure very, very seriously. And so the job of a health physicist, which is what I am, is to make sure that those exposures are limited and we have standards that and limits that we don't exceed. And then we have practices that are intended to keep the doses even lower than that. So good safety practices to keep the doses lowered. So there are some cases where, as a course of your daily work, that you will receive some radiation exposure. I mean, this is even in my job as a professor here at the university. I wear a radiation dosimeter. I work with radioactive materials. I do get very small radiation exposure. But the limits are set so low to prevent any sort of acute response and really to make the risks what we consider negligible.
There are those who say that low doses are dangerous. Once again, are you concerned or surprised at the degree of anxiety there seems to be among the public? Do people really understand it?
I'm not surprised at the degree of anxiety, so one of the reasons I'm doing interviews like right now is to try and convince the public that the risks, particularly to us on the West Coast, are really simply not there, and that doing something like taking potassium iodide, which for some people they can be allergic to the iodine, it's really not a necessary thing, nor is it a particularly wise thing to do. I mean, if they really want to use iodine, and the whole reason you do it is to block radioactive iodine from getting into your body, go eat shellfish, go eat additional iodized salt on your food. That's going to give you really what you need, and don't go out and buy potassium iodide. I mean, it's completely unnecessary.
People who think the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is on the side of the nuclear industry are very skeptical about all of this. Now, with the director of the NRC saying that the radiation is extremely high, what do you suppose that means for people in Japan?
Well, certainly the radiation levels, they have been fluctuating tremendously, and we are all very anxiously watching what is happening over in Japan. The radiation levels in the plant, from what we've seen, are definitely very, very high. But the general public has been moved many, many kilometers away from the plant site, and radiation levels drop off tremendously with distance. And so the people I would be concerned about are the workers in the plant, but it sounds like they're taking efforts to maintain their doses at reasonable levels.
Actually, they raised, though, the level of exposure that's acceptable.
That's very true, and part of that reflects the fact that we set our operational radiation protection limits so very low that we don't expect to have, well, we know we're not going to have any acute radiation response at these levels, and what we're really trying to do is manage future risk from cancer causation.
Well, Professor Kathleen Higley, again, head of the Department of Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics at Oregon State, thank you so much for being on our program.
I was delighted to be here. Thank you very much.
I'll be right back on Which Way, L.A.
You're listening to Which Way, L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way, L.A. The latest field poll says 58% of California voters like Governor Brown's plan for closing the $26 billion state budget gap. He wants half made up with spending cuts and half by extending expired taxes on income, sales, and vehicles, but only if voters approve that in a special election. Democrats have enough votes to give him the cuts, but Republicans are required to put the tax extensions on the ballot in June. Needs a two-thirds vote. The GOP's official position is no, but today's LA Times reports that five Republicans are negotiating with the governor and asking him for some major concessions. Eric Hoag is a host on Sacramento's conservative talk radio station KTKZ AM 1380. And Eric, good to have you on our program.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you for the time.
What are the Republicans offering up in exchange for their support for putting this on the ballot?
Well, I believe the Republicans would like to see a full ballot representing a lot of ideology going forward. And so right now the G5 and some other Republicans are talking about government reforms, pension reforms, and spending reforms. And government reforms are talking about contracting out. The pension reforms, of course, numerous topics surrounding 401ks for government workers. And spending reforms would be a spending cap idea. And the point for the Republicans is to see if indeed Governor Jerry Brown wants people to vote on this budget and have a say in this budget. The GOP-5 is saying, that's great, we support that. Let's put Jerry Brown's tax prop on the ballot and then three reform ideas from the Republican Party, and let's let the people vote.
According to the LA Times, the major reform they're asking for is a change in CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, which environmentalists are furious about. What does that involve, as far as you know?
Well, they would like to see some major corporations here in California expand, which would equate jobs. The Republican position is that over-regulation by the government here prohibits a lot of big business, corporate businesses, telecommunication businesses in California to expand, to grow, which means jobs added to the economy right now. And so, as always, Republicans with their ideas talking about a controlled smaller government and more private sector growth, which produces revenue for the state budget, and you do that through jobs. So that's one of the ideas being tossed back and forth in these negotiations.
You're a pretty tough conservative. The party is saying, no way, we shouldn't do this at all. What do you think?
I disagree with that. I think this is an opportunity. I believe this is the first time in about 20 years where Republicans here, in a wide minority, as I talk to you in the shadows of the state capitol, have some leverage and have some say. It's the national conversation. How big of a government do we want? What about the expenses of these unions going forward? And if you're going to talk about a $51 billion tax increase over 5 years, why just cuts for this year? Why don't we look at cost-saving measures going forward? And if we can negotiate, and some would say strike a deal with the governor, or I would say come to a prudent position of numerous props on the battle, opposite or on the ballot, opposite of the tax ballot, I think that's a win for the Republican Party. I think the party begins to stand for something and not just against it, not just being obstructionists. And that creates more buy-in for the GOP here in California from independents and decline to state voters.
Eric Hogue again with the station KTKZ AM 1380 in Sacramento. Darius Srego is a longtime Democratic Party consultant. He's also a lawyer based here in Los Angeles. Darius Srego, good to have you back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Is it time for the Democrats to do some compromising? What about this idea that Eric Hogue is expressing, and some Republicans are at least expressing a part of, that these major issues about what we really want from government ought to go on the ballot?
Oh, hey, I agree with everything that Eric just said. I mean, he and I will disagree on substance and on policy. But on policy, I mean, Eric, I think is totally right. You know, we've got to get over this notion of that it's my way or the highway. I mean, that's not what the democratic process with a small d is. It's not what this government is supposed to be. And I give the governor an incredible amount of credit, as much as I could possibly muster up here, for being willing to sit down and have these conversations with the Republicans. And they're not going to be easy conversations, because there's very significant disagreement on a lot of the substance. But the important thing is that our process was designed for compromise. And you know, there's only one way to go through what we're doing. If we want to come up with a solution, this is how it has to happen.
Well, are the Democrats going to go for changes in CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, for contracting out, for 401ks to replace pensions and spending limits, as Eric Hogue suggests? And do they really belong in a discussion about the budget?
I think they do belong in a discussion about the budget, because we have a budget process that requires the Democrats, who have huge majorities in both the Assembly and the State Senate, to get some Republican votes, and that's just the way the system is designed. And do I agree on a lot of the things that the Republicans want? Are most Democrats going to agree with the Republicans on these things? No. But, you know, none of us have a monopoly on the truth. I mean, the political process is about splitting babies and coming up with solutions that work for everybody. If you don't do that, which is just what we lived through for 8 years with a governor who preferred to be the Terminator and who actually would not accept that this is the political process, you wind up where we are today.
Let me go back to Eric Hogue. It's my understanding that some party leaders want to label as traitors any Republican who's willing to negotiate with the governor at all. Is that going to happen to these particular five that have made these offers?
Well, I certainly hope not. I mean, we have some faction in the party that believes that control is more important than success, and I think they're wrong in their attempt here to censor Republicans or defund Republicans because they want to negotiate a deal to put a tax prop on the ballot. It's not a direct tax vote for taxes. It's to give people a voice and a vote on what they want out of their government. I mean, if that's the case for the CRA, which is representing this at the convention, then before they get to me, they're going to have to go back and censor and defund Abe Lincoln and his income tax and Ronald Reagan in 1968. I don't think they would do that, and I think that would shine the light on how this attempt to control is not a successful path.
Darius Schrago, what about the unions, the teachers, the public employees in particular, and the environmentalists? Will they punish the Democrats if they go along with this?
Well, you know, look, it's in the short term, within the equivalent in Sacramento of the Capitol Beltway in D.C., there will be recriminations, there'll be fingers being pointed, there'll be blame being placed if we wind up with a compromise, and that'll be on both sides of the aisle. But, you know, at some point, enough of our elected officials have to realize that we all have to live here together. We're all Californians. The way the place works is none of us gets everything we want. We all give up a little bit. I think what's important for the governor is to make it clear that whatever pain is going to be felt is being shared, and that we're all going to suffer a little bit for the greater good. I mean, that's what this is all about, and somehow that's gotten totally, it certainly was lost because we had a governor who just didn't understand anything I just said, and you know, again, we've paid the price. So, you know, sure, I mean, it's not going to be neat, it's not going to be clean, there's going to be some hard feelings, but, you know, we got to make California work.
The legislature had scheduled votes on the first part of the budget, the cuts that the governor has proposed today. They probably will be passed by the Democrats. What happens after that, Darius Schrago? Do you think there's time to get something on the ballot in June?
It's getting very, very close. But again, this is classic traditional politics. It's going to be tough if something doesn't happen quickly to get this election scheduled for June. But, you know, politicians don't give stuff up easily because of everything you said, Warren, because of the price they think they're going to pay, unless their backs are to the wall. So, you know, at this point, their backs are pretty close to that wall.
Eric Hogue, what if the Republicans don't start being for something instead of being against everything?
Well, they're looking at 2012 coming up with a brand new football field to play on, with new districts and, of course, an open ballot and primary. So I believe they got to get back to leading and being for something so people can buy in. I mean, we're the party of the private sector. We're the party of business. And let's take a business model here. People want to buy into your product, to your representation, to your ideology. We need shareholders to invest and fund once again. And once that happens, you're going to find some of the independents and some of the declined estate voters say, hey, I like the ideas of the Republican Party. I mean, even in this budget battle right now, there are proposals for Governor Jerry Brown to say yes to. In a way, Governor Jerry Brown is saying no because of the Republicans' negotiations to put props on the ballot. We could go to the ballot right now, tax prop, and then two or three props on government reform, and let the people vote on a ballot that would be a referendum of the type of government they want going forward. If the Republicans can create that conversation here, I think they grow and can become a majority in the years to come.
So you'd put more than one item on the June ballot then? It wouldn't just be Governor Brown's vote on the extension of the taxes?
You know, that would all depend upon the negotiations between the governor and the GOP-5 and whatever numbers want to sit there and talk. I just want to talk. I believe the Republican Party has an advantage right now and a chance to represent people and to be for something. When we are for something, people will stand with the Republican Party again because the ideas make sense. It was Ronald Reagan who had Democrats vote for him because he had ideas that solved problems. Let's get back to that.
Eric Hogue, host of The Eric Hogue Show in Sacramento on KTKZ AM 1380. Darius Schrago in Los Angeles, Democratic political consultant. Thanks to both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman only back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. If voters don't approve the tax extensions that Governor Brown has asked, which we just heard so much about, school districts will face another round of layoffs. Yesterday, the last of 7,300 pink slips went to teachers at the LA Unified School District, including some at Melrose Avenue Elementary, a math science magnet. Here is Gina Olin-Buenga.
I got two copies of the pink slip this weekend on Saturday. A certified copy, and when I opened it, I thought, again, the district has experienced layoffs for the last 4 years, and it's only been the last 2 years that I've been receiving layoff notices just based on my seniority and how far up I am. I was safe before, but now 7 years worth of teaching isn't long enough to prevent receiving a layoff notice.
Ms. Oldenbanger teaches the fifth grade. Robin Wynn Davis did not get a notice. She teaches third grade.
The budget is being slashed tremendously by a huge amount of money, and we're being forced to make decisions, terrible decisions, and we have several options, and they're all pitiful options, but we're being forced to decide on the least detrimental for kids. We're a math, science, technology school, and we're being asked to choose between a math coordinator, a science coordinator, a technology coordinator, money to fund the lab. Well, what if we take money from here, then we don't have to buy supplies for the kids? What if we take money from here and we can ask the kids to bring their own pencils and paper? I mean, this is ridiculous. It really is, and our scores went up the most in the state of California last year. People have been coming from all over the place to interview our teachers, to come to see what we do here, and it's going to be a shame that we can't even do what we do next year because of money.
Howard Bloom covers education for the LA Times. Howard, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Warren.
A pretty sad story that those teachers are telling. What are the prospects that Oldenbanger will be, in fact, laid off?
Well, it's... It's possible. It's possible. Even a teacher with 7 years seniority, it's not a certain thing. You know, there's going to be a problem in LA Unified, even if the governor's budget passes. Right now, LA Unified is looking at a $408 million general fund deficit. They're also losing federal stimulus funds, $108 million in Title I, which is for underprivileged kids, and special ed disabled kids, $76 million. That's gone away as well. If the governor's budget passes, then their deficit, their $408 million deficit drops to $225 million. And so to me, that, you know, that still doesn't bode well in terms of bad things happening.
What are the economic consequences to the decisions made yesterday by the school board on how many new charters there's going to be and who's going to run them?
Well, there is going to be an impact. Even in the, Superintendent Cortina has recommended that some of the new schools or struggling schools go to charters. And when that happens, the impact on the district side is that there will be more layoffs because there will be jobs that used to be, union jobs in the district, and those jobs don't exist anymore. And those jobs also support district infrastructure, so you have to adjust it on that. And now those charters will be hiring teachers, but they don't have to hire the same teachers. They can hire, so the impact will be that there will be potentially hundreds of additional layoffs on the district side, although charter schools will be hiring teachers if there are more charter schools.
Howard, what's the connection between the pink slips and the charter schools?
The connection is that when the district authorizes another charter school, it means that there are that many more jobs that will not be district jobs, and those district jobs are related to the union contract, and the effect is more layoffs on the district side. And literally, there will be hundreds of jobs, district jobs, that will no longer exist because of the decisions the board made yesterday to approve more charter schools. Now, it should be said that the charter schools will be hiring teachers, so there will be jobs available on that side, but they're not obligated to hire the same people.
Superintendent Cortinas made recommendations. The board didn't accept them all. Who ultimately, as far as charter school applicants are concerned, were the winners and losers?
Well, basically, the major charter organizations in the region, most of them got something. They kind of made, and in some ways, it was sort of a coordinated bid. They didn't bid on every school. And in most cases, they did not bid on the same school. There were a couple of cases they went head-to-head, but not many. And so the names that people who know when they hear of charter schools, Green Dot, Alliance, Synergy, Puck, if you know the names of major charter school organizations in the area, those are the ones who got the charter schools.
So, Howard, tell us a little bit about the politics of the board. Just after the elections, for one thing, now that there's going to be a transition from Superintendent Cortinas to his replacement.
Well, okay. We still have very similar board politics in a certain way. The mayor's, a majority of board members supported by Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, they're still the board majority. The person that they wanted to be superintendent is coming in, John Dacey. And you know, yesterday we saw that this board was willing to be more aggressive in terms of relinquishing the control of schools than the outgoing superintendent was. And the outgoing superintendent certainly did want to hand over some schools to the management of charter organizations, but the board wanted to go further. They basically took his recommendations and upped the ante because they feel that these reforms are the way to go, and that, you know, they love the competition, everybody competing to run these schools, and they're impressed with the performance of charter schools, and they want to see charter schools operating on more regular LA Unified campuses. And you saw that reflected in the board decisions.
What did the mayor have to say about it?
Well, he is walking a fine line these days. He does not want to be seen as someone who is just pro-charter schools. What he says, he's in favor of good schools, and he thinks bad charter schools should be shut down. But he also says things like, you know, give these schools to organizations with a proven track record. Well, if you're a group of teachers who's competing against a charter school that's been existing, well, the group of teachers doesn't have a proven track record because they've just started. So some people read that as code language in support of charter schools. And he did have a press conference today in which he applauded the board's actions. So he certainly supports the charter school operators, but he doesn't want to be seen as coming in only on the side of charters.
Well, Howard Bloom, thanks as always for being with us.
My pleasure.
Covers education for the LA Times. You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, is the war in Afghanistan being forgotten on Which Way LA? Warman Alney back with Which Way LA. President Obama's commander in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, is in Washington this week, making his first official public reports since he was appointed last year. He talked to a Senate committee yesterday and a House counterpart today, but he's not getting much news coverage, and he's unlikely to make a dent in public opinion, which has turned against the longest war in United States history. Gary Langer polls for ABC News, among other clients. Gary, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
You've reported that 64% of the people you talked to said the war was not worth fighting?
Yeah, that's gone 2-to-1 negative now. Only 31% say the war in Afghanistan has been worth fighting, considering its costs versus its benefits. It's an ongoing question. It turned negative some time ago, but not to this extent. This is now, for the first time, the level of discontent with this war that we saw for a long period about the war in Iraq.
The war in Iraq. When you say costs versus benefits, what costs are people concerned about? What benefits do they see?
Well, this is really the equation that comes into play whenever Americans assess whether a war is justified, whether a persuasive rationale for getting involved in a war has been presented. The question is not, do you want to go to war or have a war? Very few people do. But is it necessary? What's the cost in lives and in dollars? In damage and reputation, and what's the benefits to the country? Only when the cost-benefit analysis is positive will you find public support for war. Now, it's not only about casualties, but casualties are an important element. It's also about whether the public is satisfied that it's working out, that it's serving the stated purpose, and that it's, in fact, enhancing the United States in terms of security or whatever other rationale is put forward.
Seems to me the purpose has changed. Originally, it was a response to 9/11. It was an effort to find Osama bin Laden, but now it's something different.
Yeah, initially this war had very broad support, far more than we ever saw for the war in Iraq, and that's because the persuasive rationale really was there in the beginning. There was a clear nexus between al-Qaeda and its attacks on the United States. And its safe harbor in Afghanistan, and there was very substantial public support for going to war there and for removing al-Qaeda. But over the years, I think the public has gone increasingly disenchanted with the course of the war, with the apparently changing mission there, and certainly with the costs and casualties and the damage done.
What do you think it might take to change public opinion, sway it back in favor of the war?
That is really a tough sell, because even in a place like Iraq, once attitudes turned against the war, they really didn't recover, even though the fighting ultimately calmed down. The country was to some extent pacified and withdrawal began. Right now, we find that in this most recent survey we've done, three-quarters of Americans, 73%, say they'd like to see substantial withdrawal of U.S. forces beginning this summer. Far fewer think it will happen, and that's fueling as well the discontent we see.
What about Afghans? You've also polled them.
Yeah, we've done 6 national polls in Afghanistan, and very frankly, the last one we did late last year, reported in December, points to some of these same problems. There were sharply, in many cases, more negative views of the United States and more concerns about the course of events in the country among Afghans overall. And that's because of the extent of Taliban inactivity in that country. It's been sort of like pushing on a balloon. You can suppress it in one area and it just bulges out in another. So we found broad progress in Helmand and to some extent in Kandahar, where U.S. and NATO efforts are focused. But elsewhere in the country, we found increased reports of Taliban activity and greater discontent with the way things are going.
Gary Langer, again, the founder and president of Langer Research Associates and chief pollster for ABC News. It's always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
General Petraeus told senators yesterday that the Taliban's momentum since 2005 has been arrested in much of the country and reversed in a number of important places. He added this.
However, while the security progress achieved over the past year is significant, it is also fragile and reversible. Moreover, it is clear that much difficult work lies ahead with our Afghan partners to solidify and expand our gains in the face of the expected Taliban spring offensive.
Yohi Drizin is senior defense correspondent for the National Journal. Talked to us yesterday after the Senate testimony. Yohi, good to have you back on our program.
Hey, Warren, good to be back with you.
Today, the general testified before a House committee. Did he say anything significantly different? Was there a different approach to him among the House members from the approach of the senators yesterday?
You know, he said two tidbits that were on the first half of your question that were slightly newsier and more interesting than yesterday. He said that without going into how many troops would leave this summer, and the presumption is it won't be many, he said that they would include both combat troops and support troops. Prior to today, the feeling had been they'd mostly be support troops, you know, engineers who help build and maintain U.S. facilities, for example, and not combat troops. He also publicized something that had been, at the request of the Pentagon, kept fairly secret by military reporters like myself, which was that one of his sons was in Afghanistan as an infantry officer, and that son just finished his tour and is now back in the U.S. While the younger Petraeus was deployed forward, the Pentagon had requested that it not be publicized to try to keep that young soldier as safe as possible. To other half of your question, some of the questioning from the in the House panel, especially from the Democrats, was a lot more pointed than what you saw yesterday. Yesterday, there was a total lack of urgency and sort of a feeling almost of boredom and apathy about the war. You had some of that today in the sense of, again, a kind of empty hearing room and, again, people wandering in, asking their questions and wandering out. But you did see moments where there was flashes of anger from some of the questioners or flashes of passion, basically along the lines of, first you said 2011 would be a major withdrawal, then it was 2014. Now you're saying we may have bases beyond 2014. When will this war end, and how much more will we spend in both lives and money before it comes to a close?
How did he answer those questions?
He deferred the first question. He said that, you know, that's in some ways above his pay grade, that his job is to fight the war with the resources he has and to provide President Obama with options for future withdrawals. But He acknowledged fairly bluntly that this war would not be ending anytime soon. As he did yesterday, he talked about how 2011 would, without question, be bloodier than 2010, which had been the record for U.S. casualties, for NATO casualties, for Afghan casualties. So he didn't sugarcoat the fact that there's a lot of fighting and a lot of death still to come, nor did he sugarcoat the fact that we're not going to be leaving Afghanistan anytime soon.
What did he say he was looking at as he prepares his advice and recommendations to President Obama?
He didn't get into, it's a good question you ask, Warren. He didn't really get into how he would design that very difficult calculus, not only of how many troops could he pull out, but from what parts of the country could he pull them out, which is it's a very difficult question because as recently as 6 months ago, if people were looking at Afghanistan and thinking what parts of the country are safe, what parts are not, they would say, the dangerous parts are the south, Helmand and Kandahar, which we hear so much about, and the east along the border with Pakistan. The safe parts would be north and west. In the last few months, you've seen terrible deterioration in those same areas. So now the north and the west in some cases are just as dangerous as the south and the east. So for him, it's a series of interlocking questions. the one that I think in this country we care about the most is how many troops come home. The question that he cares about the most is where do you take those troops out of, and do you shift other troops around to try to prevent areas that may be bad now from getting worse in the future?
How about determining what the capabilities are, not only of the Afghan security forces, but also of the Afghan government's ability to deliver basic services and be regarded as legitimate? Did he talk about those?
He did, and that was something that I was, you know, as an observer of today's hearing and yesterday's hearing, I was kind of glad to see that he was asked about that. I mean, the corruption both of the Karzai family and the Karzai government is well-documented and fairly staggering. It's something that represents an enormous source of public fury within Afghanistan towards the Karzai government, and something that is a strategic threat to the U.S. But it was not discussed yesterday at the Senate hearing at all. Today it was discussed. He answered kind of by rote. He said that he believed President Karzai personally was committed to the anti-corruption fight. He didn't get into whether that held true for Karzai's relatives or the Karzai government. He did acknowledge that it would be hard to have success there unless the Afghan government was seen as legitimate. But again, he didn't get into questions of whether he personally, other than the fact that it was the elected government, whether he personally felt it had earned that legitimacy or had not.
Yoheed Reason, once again, a senior defense correspondent for the National Journal. Alyssa Rubin is the Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times, speaks to us from Afghanistan. Alyssa Rubin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
How would you assess the way that Afghans feel toward their own government right now?
Well, it is always a little bit difficult to tell because people here are somewhat reluctant to say exactly what they're thinking. But there's quite a bit of skepticism about the Karzai government's ability to take over the security tasks that are being done by the Americans and the Europeans, the British, the overall NATO coalition. But, of course, a lot of those soldiers are Americans. And there's quite a bit of fear that, in fact, the police and the Afghan National Army are not ready to handle the level of the insurgency. And that is looming now because the transition to Afghan control is actually, it's going to be announced, the first tranche of it will be announced for on Monday, which is the official, is a national holiday. It's the first day of spring, March 21st, and the new year. And that is, I think, being looked at with some trepidation. Not that, of course, the troops will disappear immediately, but it's a signal. And I think a lot of people are very much in a wait-and-see mode. And at the same time, they're skeptical because the Afghan government has yet to really be able to deliver a lot of, as you mentioned in your conversation with Yogi, basic services. And so there's a feeling, well, if they can't deliver basic services, how can they possibly deliver safety?
How do the Afghans seem to feel about the American presence at this point?
Well, it really depends whether there's much fighting in the area. Clearly, in places where there have been recent civilian casualties, and that is notably in Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan, there's quite a bit of resentment of NATO troops, and it's not only there, but obviously wherever there's been a recent civilian casualty, and there were several, at least two, possibly three, very very serious incidents in the last about month, where nine boys were killed as they were gathering firewood by NATO gunships. That the Americans are really, and the coalition brings sort of an awful lot of trouble and grief to Afghanistan, and that they would be better off without them. At the same time, there's that deep ambivalence. We saw it also in Iraq that the troops, the foreign troops, bring a certain degree of order that they don't trust their own troops to be able to maintain. So I think you see a bit of both.
Okay. Again, Alyssa Rubin, Kabul Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Lieutenant General David Borno is retired from the U.S. Army. He's a senior advisor and senior fellow now at the Center for New American Security. Spent more than 30 years in the Army, commanded 20,000 troops in Afghanistan in 2003 and 2004. General, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Warren.
What do you think about the war and the conduct of the war so far? Earlier we heard that the American people don't see a rationale at this point. What about it?
Well, I think we've gone through several phases in the war in Afghanistan, a much different war during the time I was there 5 years ago than the one that's there today. The enemy has escalated significantly since that time and is putting a lot of pressure on the Afghan government. The U.S. and NATO has kind of done a counter-escalation here during President Obama's first 2 years in office. And so you've got a much more serious fight going on there today than you've had in many, many years. And I think one of the things also to point out today is that, as some of our earlier guests noted, the objectives and effect have changed there. I think our objectives are now more regional in terms of looking at our vital interests across this whole region than they are simply about what I call the island of Afghanistan, which is where we tend to focus perhaps somewhat too much of our attention as we look at what our regional interests are there.
So our interests then have changed. The rationale for the war itself has changed.
In my mind, our vital interests include certainly al-Qaeda and ensuring that they can no longer have a base to attack the United States. But I think there's at least two other vital interests we have in that part of the world. One is to keep nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of terrorists, to include al-Qaeda and other groups out there. And second is to prevent a nuclear war from happening on the subcontinent between India and Pakistan. That particular issue and the general control of nuclear weapons out there is of extraordinarily high interest to the United States. Now, our presence in Afghanistan doesn't directly affect India v. Pakistan in their conflict, but our long-term choices that are going to be coming up in front of us here is going to have an immense impact on whether that region remains relatively stable or plunges into an even worse civil war or a broader nuclear conflict, I think, in the coming years.
Is it more difficult to keep troops motivated when you have these more general kinds of goals than originally did when you were commanding troops there in 2003 and 2004?
Well, I think I've got two sons that are Army captains, and one's been to Afghanistan and one's going. And so I get some pretty direct feedback on what life is like for the soldiers out there on the ground. And I served in combat as a junior officer many years ago myself. So I think the troops that are out there fighting every day are focused on their mission at hand, as Alyssa pointed out, directly to their front. They're focused on taking care of their buddies and trying to do their best every single day and get home in one piece. It's really the responsibility of the national leaders here in Washington to think about the bigger issues and to make sure that this transition that's coming up in front of us it makes what we've done over the last 10 years worthwhile. We don't want to squander the tremendous sacrifices that have been made by American troops out there by doing something that doesn't make sense in the terms of our long-term vital interests in that part of the world. And I think the transition roadmap that's been laid out that takes us out to the end of 2014 makes a tremendous amount of sense. I think the American people support that roadmap. But even more importantly is what happens at the end of 2014 and whether the United States is committed to having a long-term presence, even a very small presence, out in this part of the world. And I think it's essential that we do so.
I don't want to take issue with you, but the pollster we heard from earlier said 64% of the American people don't think the fight's worth it anymore.
Well, that's true. But I also would take you back to the congressional election that was just concluded in November and make the observation that the war and opposition to the war wasn't even on the radar screen in this election. That actually bothered a number of folks that are out there in uniform that they're out there fighting, and it's not even part of the debate back in the United States. So while the polls, I agree, show that the American people have some concerns about this, I think, number one, it's not showing up in the political dynamic. And I also think that the administration probably needs to come back out and talk about why this is important. We don't hear a lot of senior administration officials out there, up to and including the president, talking about the importance of what our vital interests are in this part of the world. We're not in Afghanistan because it's a humanitarian interest alone. We're there because we have vital national interests in this part of the world.
Yeah, I want to go back to Yohei Adrizan with the National Journal, talking particularly about the Senate committee hearing where General Petraeus was testifying. You told us yesterday and a little bit more today, Yohei, that there didn't seem to be a lot of interest amongst the senators, either Democrat or Republican.
That's right. And you know, I would also point out, just in response to General Barnard's point a moment ago, I follow this very closely. I mean, as the small number of journalists who write about this with regularity try to do. And I honestly myself can't tell you what the administration strategy for Afghanistan is or when it's likely to come to an end. I mean, if you think back to the strategy review that the White House did with great fanfare when it first took office, they made a point of saying that what they wanted to do was prevent al-Qaeda from returning to Afghanistan, and what they didn't want to do was any kind of full-blown nation-building campaign in one of the poorest, most landlocked, most deprived, most illiterate countries on the planet. Flash forward to General McChrystal's tenure and now General Petraeus' tenure, and what we're doing across Afghanistan, I just came back a few months back from a long series of events there, but what we're doing across Afghanistan looks exactly like nation-building. We're doing economic development. We're trying to help build and rehabilitate schools and medical centers. All of those things can and probably are very worthy, but that is nation-building. That is not a narrowly defined counterterror mission. So you have the kind of confusion about what the mission is, and then you have dates that continue to change. You had 2011 initially held up as the start of a significant withdrawal. Then that was walked back from. Then 2014 was supposed to be the end point. Now that's being slightly walked back from. So that it's, I think voters are not mistaken in wondering exactly what it is we're trying to do and exactly how much longer we're going to be there. Even here in Washington, it's not clear what the answers to either of those questions are.
General Barno, remind our listeners, you commanded 20,000 troops there in 2003 and 2004. Are you confused about the current situation and strategy?
No, I don't think so. I think the area that I have questions about, though, is what comes next. What's at the end of all this? And I think that may be the most important part of the message that's missing right now. If you're a Pakistani policymaker, if you're an Iranian policymaker, if you're India, if you're Russia, if you're one of the northern stands there and you're looking at what's going to come next and how should you place your bets on the table today, you really don't know where the United States is going. And I would make the argument that having certainty about a long-term, very small, but a long-term American presence in this part of the world is very much in our interest and will cause these countries that we have concerns about to make decisions that are going to support our interests down the road. And leaving that uncertainty out there, I think, actually works against us. We hear all the time about the Pakistanis hedging their bets and betting on both sides and being duplicitous. But if you're a Pakistani national security advisor and you don't know what's going to come out there and you have a history of the United States leaving this part of the world, you've got pretty good reason to think that that's going to happen again and that you want to have yourself positioned best for the day after the Americans are gone. So I think we have to be very careful that for whatever reasons, domestically back here at home or in our position in the world, that we don't leave this door open indefinitely. We need to talk about what our long game is going to be in this part of the world.
Talking with Lieutenant General David Barno, now retired after 30 years in the Army and a command post in responsibility in Afghanistan as well. Leslie Gelb is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of Power Rules, How Common Sense Can Save U.S. Foreign Policy. And he won a Pulitzer Prize in 1985 while he was a columnist at the New York Times. So he's had a foot in two different camps. Leslie Gelb, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here.
Does this strategy, as outlined by David DeBarno and by General Petraeus today in Washington, make sense?
Not to me. I'm not in favor, as you well know, of just picking up and leaving Afghanistan. We can't do that. We've got a 2014 deadline to turn over combat responsibility to Afghanistan. I would like to speed up that process. We've been there for 10 years already. We've more than given the Afghans a chance to take up responsibility for their own freedom, for their own cause. Just look at the Japanese. Look at how their people are gathering themselves up to take care of their problems without whining and without the corruption and without the hell of having to deal with the Afghan government. They do it. The Afghan government has had plenty of time to do it, too. So have the Pakistanis, the ultimate hypocrites in this, because they condemn us for not staying longer in Afghanistan, even as they help the Taliban, who are trying to kill us. It makes no sense whatsoever. And they provide safe haven for those Taliban, and then they continue complaining about the United States being likely to leave. You know, there's just so long you can be the sucker. General Bono correctly stated three vital interests for the United States, none of which apply now to the situation in Afghanistan. One is to fight international terrorism. International terrorism is no longer based or centered in Afghanistan. You've got it in Pakistan, in Somalia, in Yemen. It's all over the place, and we have to adjust accordingly. Secondly, it's to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons into dangerous extremist hands. Well, the dangerous extremist hands are potentially the Pakistanis. And what the devil can we do about them by draining ourselves in Afghanistan in a war about which they're being total hypocrites? And finally, as the general himself said, we have an interest in preventing war, particularly nuclear war, between Pakistan and India. And as he himself said, Afghanistan doesn't have much to do with that. So what are we doing there?
General Barno, what do you say to that? And does it, why does it help to stay in Afghanistan if the real problem is Pakistan?
I think staying with a limited American presence, and I'm talking about, you know, perhaps 25,000 or so forces here beyond 2014, is an anchor point for all the other actors in that region. If that anchor point's gone, I think there's a fairly high probability you're going to see Afghanistan tip back into some type of civil war that most of the external actors have their fingers in and have proxies fighting out again for in support of their interests in Afghanistan, which is not an outcome we're looking for. But more importantly, though, all the actors today will make their bets based upon the Americans departing the footprint out there, the Americans no longer being part of the fabric, no longer a serious influence in the region. So I think those all work against our interests. And I don't think you can throw your hands up in the air with regard to Pakistan. It's a very, very complex, difficult problem. I just got back from a week-long trip there at the end of January and actually was there when the American had the shooting with the two Pakistanis. And it is a very vexing and very difficult country, but it's also one that the United States simply can't walk away from and hope that the region is going to be okay without our continued engagement there.
Leslie Gelb, can we just walk away? And
I don't want to walk away either. I just can't figure out what to do. And I haven't thrown up my hands. I keep searching for some reasonable answer where we aren't the sucker. That's what I can't stand. You know, the United States being the sucker and our throwing away our the lives of the best Americans to be a sucker to these people. I don't get it. You know, how they have the nerve to criticize us for not wanting to stay in Afghanistan indefinitely while they help the Taliban to kill our troops. That is utterly inexcusable.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. Yohei Drizin with the National Journal, retired General David Borno, formerly with the Army, now at the New American Security Center for the New American Security. Leslie Gelb, a former president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Our earlier guests, Alyssa Rubin of the New York Times in Kabul, and Gary Langer with ABC News, the pollster. Good to have you with us. Thank you very much for being on our program today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Jacob Conrad, and Daryl Satzman. Our managing producers, Karen Radziner. Technical director, Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. Join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.